Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll talk about surveillance with fellow retired FBI Special Agent John Griffin, who spent his career in the FBI New York field office and who worked some of New York's most crucial criminal and terrorism-related cases as part of the FBI New York Special Operations Group. But before I get to the interview with John, let me start with a quick cybersecurity news item. Since next week is the presidential election, I want to talk briefly on election security-related items. Bottom line up front, you should feel confident that our election process is secure and that your vote will count. This week, I was guest on another podcast called Information Assured and had a discussion specifically on this topic with a couple CISOs, and it's worth a listen if this is a topic you're concerned with. Matthew Hall is the host. You can find it on all of the regular podcasting locations, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and so on. Again, that's Information Assured. But as far as should you be concerned with foreign actor influence into the election, this is something that has been in the news lately a lot, specifically with the Russians, although there's been some news reports recently with the Chinese and Iranians' attempts to influence in our election. The first thing I would say is, A, are we surprised this is happening? Nation states have been interfering with the political process of their adversaries for hundreds of years. In 1610, Moscow and the Russian government at the time was trying to influence Polish election by paying nobles to vote or influence their elections in certain ways. This has been going on forever. All that has changed is technology. With the advances in technology, it makes it very easy for nation-state actors to take a look at the technology available to them and to be able to influence elections and other items that way simply because it's easy to do. In the past, they would have had to send people over to try to do influence campaigns and try to compromise individuals and things of that nature. But in general, now with technology, it's very easy to remotely put up posts on Facebook or tweet things that favor or disfavor a certain candidate. And in the polarized political climate we're in, it makes it very easy for those items, especially if they're disinformation-focused campaigns, to get legs and start running. So that's why you see a lot of these conspiracy theory items coming up online. You see news reports talking about it. You see people arguing over it simply because it's easy to do. Are nation states behind it? Absolutely. Now, on the other hand, are they hacking into our election systems and compromising the voting systems? I will say they are attempting to. In 2016, the Russians certainly got into the voting system, not the voting systems, but like the network infrastructure for county voting, county election departments. But that never resulted in any votes being changed. So do I fear that in 2020 there's going to be votes changed? I do not. There's a lot of other issues with mail-in votes and all that stuff that we're not going to discuss here. My bigger concern is not for 2020, but it's for 2024. And I'm going to predict this now here that this is going to be election security is going to be a huge issue in 2024 because of the advent of artificial intelligence and other technologies we do not currently know about. Because in 4 years, we can only imagine how technology is going to expand between now and then. But for 2020, if you're worried about voting, do not be worried about it. The election process is as secure as it can be. The federal government, by the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, are taking certain measures to ensure the integrity of the election. And there's no reason to really have a lot of fear that our election will be compromised in that perspective. Now, again, will there be disinformation that are sponsored by nation states? Absolutely. There was a report this week of Iranians doing that by appearing to send an email out from the Proud Boys group threatening people to vote for Trump. Otherwise, they're going to come get him. You know, that's not hard to do. You could, if I wanted to, I could create a disinformation campaign in Russia today if I felt so inclined to do so. It's not that complicated. It's not that hard for our adversaries to do so. But as far as voting, it's secure. Be safe. Don't worry about it. So my guest this week is fellow FBI retired Special Agent John Griffin, who spent his entire career in the New York field office doing what I can only imagine were some crazy things and seeing some crazy things. So, John, I appreciate you coming on this week.
Thanks for having me.
How are things up in the north? Have you got snow yet?
No snow. Let's hold off on that. But okay. It is getting finally cooler.
That's good. So let's talk a little bit about your background. Where did you, because, you know, with most people who become FBI agents, if you meet another FBI agent, you get two general questions. What'd you do before the Bureau? And where was your first office? So we'll start with what's your background? Where'd you go to school? What'd you do before you joined the FBI? And how was Quantico for you?
Okay, easy enough. Manhattan College, started at engineering. Realized engineering wasn't for me. Ended up changing to School of Education, physics. When I changed over to be a physics teacher, stopped by the dean's office, and he pulled out a folder, a book on how this process goes, and told me they hadn't done that in 10 years. So I knew I had good job opportunities ahead of me. Graduated mid-year in January, got a job that afternoon teaching physics local high school. Enjoyed it, taught upstate New York or Rockland County, and then taught in Stamford, Connecticut. I took the kids one day to career day and stood on the sidelines talking to an Air Force recruiter about whether my students would be some, you know, possible candidates for his career field, and ended up signed up myself to be a pilot. So I joined the Air Force, became a pilot, flew KC-135s. Everywhere around the world. And after 7 years, spending a lot of that in the desert for family and et cetera, got out, went back to teaching up in Windsor, Connecticut, taught 2 years up there, had a variety of classes from geometry, honors geometry, gifted and talented, and eventually saw an advertisement that the FBI needed pilots. So I contacted a recruiter. Next thing you know, I'm headed to Quantico. And it turned out that due to snow days, I actually had my final exams shipped to me, FedExed overnight. And I was grading my kids' finals the first couple nights at the academy. And it was interesting. So the academy was enjoyable. It was, if you've been in the military, the FBI academy, you have a heads up on what kind of things to expect. Great classmates, great time. A good number of my classmates and I got New York, it being such an office in need permanently. We came up to New York. We started out doing background investigations on applicants, political appointees, etc. And we got shipped off to or lent to other squads for whatever was happening, whether it was a big OC, organized crime arrest, or whatever was going on. It was a great way to see the city. Having gone to Manhattan College in the Bronx, I was familiar with the city, but it was amazing how many of my classmates were not. Anyway, New York was great. I spent 13 years overhead in doing aerial surveillance. We ended up with a pretty neat aircraft that had the camera system mounted on a Predator drone mounted in it. We found one of the subjects of 9/11, that was previously untrackable, and we're able to put him in a location that they were able to follow up on. We did things like chase a tiger around Jackson, New Jersey, near Six Flags, which it wasn't from Six Flags. A number of organized crime cases where there were hits on people, et cetera. Surveillance from the air was always fascinating. Eventually decided to get down the ground. I had built up enough Marriott points with the travel that, want to see my family a bit more, and spent the last 7-8 years on a ground surveillance team. Along the way, took the test for technically trained agent, except my squad was so understaffed that at times we were doing surveillances with 4 or 5 people, which is not really optimum. So ended up finishing up with surveillance and took the master's online for cybersecurity risk policy analysis. Yep. And that's where I met you, and it's been great ever since. Retired end of 2017, started doing some cyber consulting and construction consulting. I had a background in that with some friends from the neighborhood for years and years. I had a painting business while we were in college, and now I'm back to teaching physics. Sorry if that took too long.
No, that's all good. So this is obviously usually a cybersecurity podcast. We're going to talk about a little bit of that at the end, but let's step back for a second because you have a unique perspective, I think, on 9/11, having worked in the New York field office and doing flight surveillance for the FBI in New York. So let me, before I get to the 9/11 question, so when people think the New York office, they probably think Manhattan. They think of all the skyscrapers and stuff, but how big is the New York field office? What counties does it cover? Is it all of Long Island? Is it all the way up to how far north? Does it stop at the New Jersey border? What does the New York office division area of responsibility look like?
It covers the five boroughs, plus Nassau and Suffolk. New Jersey, you know, the Hudson is our boundary to the west. And like I said, it goes out to the tip of Long Island. We have the Eastern District and the Southern District, which are usually, if it's a big case, it's going to one of those two districts. So for prosecutions, there were some terrorism cases that, due to the regulations, if somebody lands somewhere there to be prosecuted in the district in which they land, if we bring them from overseas, so there was always a big effort to make sure they land in New York somewhere so that they can be brought to the Southern or Eastern District for prosecutions. But the thing about New York, while it sounds not that big because it's five counties, the five boroughs plus Nassau and Suffolk, there's over 10% of all FBI agents are in the New York office. So there are small subdivisions in New York that are bigger than many field offices.
Yeah, so. And so taking a thought of 9/11, since you were doing air surveillance for the Bureau in New York, so I assume you flew all over from the tip of Long Island all the way back to Manhattan and all those things. How hard was it as a pilot who wasn't a very good pilot, clearly, or you know hadn't done all the pilot training, to fly a jet airliner into the World Trade Center and actually hit it? Give some perspective on as a pilot yourself. You know, what would that appear to look like to them?
The interesting thing is one of my squad mates and I were flying over the World Trade Center on Saturday before 9/11. And we could actually wave to people on the top of the building, et cetera. If you remember, that fall was extremely clear skies. It was absolutely unlimited visibility. And having flown a Boeing 707, very similar in a lot of ways, to the aircraft used in terms of size and maneuverability, you'd be surprised. There is a lot of maneuverability. And they were doing relatively high speed down the Hudson. They would have been able to see the building for basically from Albany on down. I believe the aircraft that came, they left Boston and things started going badly just short of Albany. And they turned south and ended up running towards Manhattan, and then the one that was headed out to Pennsylvania, and the Pentagon aircraft. So not really that difficult. There's simulators nowadays that are pretty realistic, very realistic, and they will give you the ability to be able to pull off whatever it is you're motivated to do. You're a teacher as well, and pretty much education's all about motivation. If you're highly motivated, you're going to get it. When we're in pilot training, everybody found their motivation to get through pilot training, and that's what you needed to get there. You could be in class on Monday morning and out of pilot training, if not out of the Air Force, by Friday afternoon. So, you know, there was an intensity to the training, and from what I understand, these people, the terrorists, they did, the ones that were acting as pilots, did obtain a lot of flight training. And again, the lessons as to why we didn't connect the dots is a different story, but they did apparently only concern themselves with learning how to fly. I believe some companies that they bought some of their simulator software, you can set up a very good simulator with right now a television and a computer, a video game console, and the right controls, and you will become relatively proficient. You're not going to have this sense of the aircraft for landings, but other than that, you're probably going to be able to pull off most of what they wanted to do. And they did, obviously. But yeah, But yeah, so we were overhead Sunday before or Saturday before it happened, and I remember watching it unfold on TV, and stunned. But
yeah, so I was in the Charlotte field office, and I was working cybercrime at the time, and obviously everybody's job changed on that day. I went from just working the normal work hours and doing cyber stuff to working or assisting the terrorism squad, and working midnights to noon was my work shift. I'll be honest with you, in Charlotte, we didn't really do a lot after the first 3 weeks or so. We did interviews of personnel that may have flown that day or were on certain flights, things like that. And I know I worked a part of a case. We had a guy in Raleigh who gave us a bunch of cart stuff. He had created the, when you buy stuff online, he had the cart software. So you put in a cart and you buy it. So he provided us everything that people had bought in that cart for the last 2 years. So I was going through that one by one, looking for people buying ammunition, flight simulator software, and cell phones. And so anybody who bought any of those mm-hmm. things, we were sending leads out to find out why were they buying. Anyway, all that to be said, that was the extent of my, how my job changed for a couple months. I got to believe in New York, it was a little different. How did that change for you? Did the ability to fly, even though you're a federal agent, did that change? Or did you just continue on with targets that were identified and surveil them and things like that?
Well, start off, we went to 12-hour shifts. I believe it was 7 to 7. I had the 7P to 7A. I was on a night shift that day anyway. But we were busy on Thursday, 2 days after the attack, one of the day crew went out to Pennsylvania and took video, which I got to see when they got back. They took video of the crash out there, and there was lots of rumors about what might have happened. You can only imagine the rumors that flew. There is one angle from which you see the outline of the aircraft hit the ground intact. So, not to make light of it, but a Wile E. Coyote roadrunner through a wall kind of image. It was basically a shadow of an aircraft that did strike the ground with a relatively low angle and the engines, et cetera. It would not have happened. And just to tell you that if there was anything major that occurred in flight, that image would not have been there. It would have been a breakup of parts and pieces. There have been Boeings that have lost aircraft, lost engines, and they've managed to fly. So, all the other scenarios, that aircraft, from what I saw, hit the ground intact. And then you also look forward to that night, Tuesday night, a bunch of our administration, the bosses, supervisor, assistant supervisor, and someone else were actually out in Dallas for helicopter training. They were able to board an American Airlines emergency flight, and I was tasked with going to fly to JFK that night to pick them up. So I made every call I could, down to headquarters, NORAD, NEADS, etc., saying I'm going to be flying an FBI aircraft to JFK that night from, Central Jersey. Well, as I got almost over my own house, the little radar system we have on board for anti-collision, all of a sudden I have a blip 6,000 feet above me, 6 miles behind me, which were the limits of the system. That blip came real close, real fast. And the F-15 shows up on the wing. I switch over to a common radio frequency and try and talk to them. Most military radios have what's called a guard channel, 243, and everybody's supposed to have that up at all times. So I broadcast, this is by our tail number, you can see it was an FBI aircraft. And he followed me all the way to New York, as the, karma would have it. We tried to get a hold of the tower at JFK, nobody answered, while we're circling off the coast of, south of Long Island, New York. The door warning came on. Next thing you know, the rear door popped open. So I had the co-pilot, sorry, you have to go back and close the door. which had never happened before, but of course happened that evening. He comes back, sits down, shakes his head, didn't want to go back there again with an open door on the aircraft, and called the tower again. Finally, somebody's basically in plain English, what do you need? So we need to land there. He goes, okay, I guess, which is not normal radio terminology. We came in and landed. We taxied to a basically a private ramp. It's not one of the major airline ramps. There's a ramp that they have for transient aircraft. We get there. We tell them we're waiting for the American Airlines flight. And I go outside to the front of the building, and you can look back to Manhattan and see, you know, the smoke trail, et cetera, because, again, the nights were very clear. This gentleman walks along, and we start talking about, can you believe this? And finally, I said, wait a second, I kind of recognize your voice. Did you answer our radio a few minutes ago? He goes, yeah, this guy just kept calling. I go, that was me. What do you do here? He goes, oh, I'm head of maintenance. So I got cleared to land at JFK by the head of maintenance. Okay. And the bosses showed up, and I flew him back home without being chased by an F-15 again.
So it was quicker. So, it was quicker for them to get a flight from JFK to Central Jersey. Did they all live in Jersey? Is that why you had to go pick them up? Oh, because they couldn't get out of the city, right? Yeah, that's right. Never mind.
That's right. Everything was locked down in the city. The only way, in fact, the next day I had to go steal or repossess the boss's cars out of Newark Airport, and somebody else was, I think, up in Westchester or LaGuardia. So, yeah, I had to show a badge and drive a car out of a locked parking lot. It was always interesting. You just never knew what was going to happen. So, yeah, that was my 9/11. And then basically Friday night that week, we ended up finding somebody who was involved. And I believe that he was in Gitmo last I was able to figure out. So still.
Yeah, good for him. So did you know, so there was two FBI agents that died in the towers, Leonard Hatton and John O'Neill. John had been retired. Did you know either one? Because they were both New York agents.
No.
Okay.
No.
But yeah, it's one of those things. New York's, what, 1,100 agents?
Something like that. Yeah, depending, on transfers, et cetera. Yeah, the agent I flew with the Saturday before, he was in O'Neill's division. And, you know, his take on John O'Neill is really, he said, the guy is, he was there for you. He was all about getting the job done. And Lenny Hatton, I forget what division he was in. I was in special operations, which is basically, we don't come under any other classification. So I think John O'Neill had been in FCI, and I forget where Lenny Hatton had been. But yeah, they you know, they both ran back in to help, and I you know, a lot of my neighbors, I'm from a town that had the greatest number of people lost that day. Some of my wife's friends lost their husbands, and my wife lost some of her high school friends, people she knew in high school that became firemen or police. I knew some of their brothers, and it was personal, and still is. But that's a whole other.
All right. So let's move on to lighter topics. That was a great conversation. I really appreciate your insight onto that. But so we met when we were both getting our master's degrees in cybersecurity online at Utica College. And at the time, you were a senior member of New York's SOG, Special Operations Group. As they still call it that. I know they've changed it like four times, but I assume it's still called that. And there's two different units. There's the SOG and the SSG. The difference is the SSG doesn't carry guns in our agents. SOGs carry guns in our agents. Do I have that right?
True. Yeah. In general, the SSGs are there for the foreign counterintelligence type activities. They will not be turned loose on a case or a criminal case or a case in which it might. Well, that when I left, it would possibly include, you know, armed and dangerous individuals. The interesting thing is a lot of them are retired PD, so they'd love to do that stuff. But however, the SOG, which is what I was, a surveillance, again, like you joke, they changed the name. We were trained, et cetera, in surveillance. We did arrests, a lot of tactical training, which was great. We actually used our own cars for events on the range, which, you know, can be interesting because it'd be kind of tough to come home with some bullet holes in your car that you put there. But knock on wood, that didn't happen. The SSG, they're very good. They're mostly used against the traditional FCI, Russian Chinese counterintelligence agents, and they're very good at that. There's a lot of resources. That's what I believe John O'Neill was in charge of.
Okay.
Because I know he had access to some of those resources.
So talk about what are some of the interesting cases you ran. So, I mean, you know, I got to believe doing that for 21, 22 years, you saw a lot of things that were head-scratching and humorous. So you talked about the Panther, right?
Tiger,
yeah. Tell us, what is that case?
It was an actual yellow Bengal tiger. There was a woman who, and the funny thing is now with everybody that the tiger, what's he called? Tiger King or Joe Exotic, et cetera.
Yeah.
I believe he had some interactions with this Joan Marasek, who, if you think of Cat Lady, she basically was gathering tigers. Believe it or not, tigers were not that tightly controlled. The federal rules on it were basically Department of Transportation or Department of Commerce. They wanted to know when these things crossed state lines, but they really weren't that concerned about who had them and why. She had federal permits for 23 animals or 22 animals. And when this one animal got loose, I had brought the plane with the infrared camera back that day from maintenance. And they switched out the crews. I was still up for seeing if I could do anything. For my friends and I, we got our radios because they are encoded. We headed over to the location as they took a local police department, local patrolman up in our plane. The plane was actually able to get on target before I got there. I drive up. I see all the activity. They had given us a rough location. And again, the key to that was we had encoded radios and no one was listening or unable to listen. I parked my car in somebody's front yard. They were on their stoop. I asked if it was okay. They said, sure. I go, well, actually, we're here chasing a tiger. They go, oh, yeah, we'll go inside if he comes out, which, okay. There was a fire truck, and on top of the fire truck were a number of people. One of them was a Six Flags Great Adventure tiger specialist. And he said right off the bat, he had all his tigers accounted for. This wasn't his, but he's here to help. I walked down the road, and the camera operator says, you just passed the fire truck? I said, yep. He says, stop. I stopped. He said, walk backwards. I walked backwards, stop, walk forwards. That way he could identify me out of all the people he was seeing with the infrared. So he locks on me and starts directing me further down the road. Finally, he says, okay, stop. It's 40 feet in the woods in front of you. With that, I look up and down the street. There's a Jackson PD lieutenant who comes walking along. I said, it's here, 40 feet in front of us. He said, okay, the FBI is coming too. I said, well, that'd actually be me. And he looks me up and down and says, did you forget something? I said, like what? He goes, a bigger gun? Because all I had was my SIG 228 9mm pistol. The rest of the evening, we spent in and out of the woods. At one point, I just walked down the driveway, and the camera operator comes over the radio and says, it's coming out to the driveway. And I said, yeah, I'm on the driveway. He goes, and you're alone. I look around. I was alone, and the animal comes out, looks around. At that point, I decided to stick around with groups of people. Eventually, we had Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game, State of New Jersey. A lot more of the local PD were out, sheriffs, Jersey troopers, everybody was adding to the mix. And the decision was made because, as Six Flags tiger specialist said, there's never been a recapture of an animal like this. You don't have a net, you don't have a cage, you don't have a choice. You're basically going to take the animal down. We ended up lining up. It was back and forth in the woods by a house that had a lawnscape business. So we had bunkers for the different colored mulch and stone, et cetera. We ended up laying in that mulch as Jackson PD marched their guys in, and also Manchester. There was a few, but I just remember Jackson, the one lieutenant I was paired up with for a while. Eventually, you could hear the guy in the plane was saying, okay, it's working. He's coming towards you. You're in the bunkers, right? I said, yep. He goes, okay. 40 feet, 30 feet. And as he starts to say 20 feet, you could see the animal jump and run through by us. And then everybody opened up except me at that point. I was only, like the guy said, only going to irritate it. the Tiger was hit. We found on the driveway, there were pieces of the tarmac missing where his claws dug in and pulled out some of the tarmac. It ran further into the woods on the other side. He was directing us towards that, towards the animal. And at one point he said, oh, he's across that pathway there. Well, in the infrared in the woods, a stream looks like a pathway. So we were now going to traipse through a stream in the dark after a wounded tiger. And he was telling us it hadn't moved, hadn't moved, hadn't moved. Finally, everybody lines up. Everybody's ready to go. Flashlight up high. One, two, three. Flashlight on. Everybody else opened up. And we pulled the animal out. It had no markings on it. I looked for ear tags, tattoos, you name it. There was nothing to indicate any talkability of the animal. And the Six Flag guy shows up and says, see, I told you, that's a yellow Bengal. I said, so? He goes, we have white Bengals and Siberians, and that's a yellow Bengal. But, you know, he gave us his advice, and it ended there. But she eventually had her animals removed from that area in New Jersey, and I think they're in Texas, living alone. She had something like 18 or 20 animals basically in a backyard, living in a trailer. And they were, the alpha male was killing the adolescent males as they came to adulthood. So that's why this one ran out. But no, I also got to work on the Hansen case, tracking him. We had to lie to our bosses as to what we were doing. A number of organized crime cases. There were some really good cyber cases towards the end that kind of developed along the way. But that was more when I was on the ground.
So if you watch TV, you watch movies, they very much romanticize doing surveillance. I'm going to guess it's not quite as romantic as the media would portray it to be.
Not in the least. A lot of waiting. A lot of, you know, you can kind of try and zero in. And with the tech that's available now, you do have some, you know, I remember the first time I saw some of the trackers used, transmitters, et cetera. And when they're first brought out, they're usually pretty effective. But then both sides figure out the limitations of the equipment. And now you're waiting for the next great step forward in how to track. But yeah, lots of boredom, lots of books read, lots of things to do. But,
lots of master's degree classes being completed.
Oh, right. Exactly. And yes, that was very convenient because yes, there was hours, especially if we had the late shifts, you know. Mm-hmm. We followed some politicians. This one particular politician was infamous for saying no, no, no to development of any kind. And then one day he would walk in and he would say, yes, 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 and we got to give money to the project. He eventually was on one of my teammates, set up in front of a restaurant, and the developer that he was dealing with was wired. The developer asked him, basically, you know you're charging twice as much as the others, which is an interesting statement in itself. And he responded with, yes, but I'm worth it. He never attempted to fight the prosecution. He took a deal because I'm not sure if it was external pressure from the friends that he basically implicated, the other politicians, or it was more, you had video of him admitting to everything. So, but yeah, he was active between 6 and maybe 10 at night. Wow. So yeah, you did have, it was, and there was a whole bunch of twists in that case.
So politicians are corrupt. Wow, that's just shocking. News being made today.
And both sides, I'm not at all.
What's the Hunter? What's the Hunter Biden you were tracking? Did I say that?
No. So, well-known names in the New York area.
I'm sure. So, I know your passion now is the schools and cybersecurity. You mentioned that you're back to teaching physics at a school near where you live. So, how have you seen both of those two things, schools and cybersecurity, evolve in 2020 with the remote learning and all that kind of stuff? What is your school doing to protect the students, to protect the network infrastructure, or are they doing anything? Are schools as bad and well behind the curve as far as cybersecurity as one would think, or are they making efforts to secure that stuff?
There are efforts made. But as you and I learned, that there's for every effort, there's a counter, and the good guys trying to do the right thing are just going to leave openings for the bad guys. One of the things that I, in my capstone that I shared way back when, was to try and develop education, and we started a cybersecurity club, and one of my major goals is to have the kids be the ambassadors for the school. And as we've started this year, again, I was a new teacher as of August 31st, employed there. I'm working with the IT team to try and bring the ideas in, the security concepts. And I believe so far that they're pretty good. We have heard of local districts that have had issues. One of the first districts I called on a few years back was someone I knew from my own district. And it was interesting because you run into that we don't have the money for it. And I was discussing how it can be relatively inexpensive to fold in the beginnings. And once you get a sense of an awareness of what the risks are, you'll be much more prepared. Everybody says, oh, we have a great IT guy and a great firewall. And that's usually 1 to 3 weeks before the incident hits the paper. The incidents in our districts were, and I don't want to, just because I would know a little bit more about them, involved everybody. It involved students asking for pictures they shouldn't of other students. It involved, at one meeting, I watched the IT guy taking everybody's device, doing something to give it back to them. And I finally said, I have to ask, what's going on? Well, somebody got one of the passwords and was watching adult material and geometry. So we had to kick everybody out, reset passwords, and start over. You know, the single factor access to all the equipment. You never want to admit what preventions you're using, but I would say it's hit or miss. Another district I spoke with, right after we have a great IT guy and a great firewall, turned out there was a teacher who was looking at the wrong kinds of material on his work device. This you just keep going and going. I could seriously spend the next 2 hours relating all these kinds of things. And I've brought that up, and it's, as you know, it would be a multi-front effort to get the awareness up. So we're doing that. The kids that I've had so far in the cybersecurity club are extremely motivated. And I think that's going to be the way we really make the most improvement, because, you know, the resistance to multi-factor authentication, the why should I have to do anything different than what I was doing 10 years ago? Well, we're doing things differently than we did August 31st, just because of the evolution. And I will say, you see districts that rely on one platform, that platform goes down, you better have plan B. And plan B, with the speed at which plan A was developed, is not ready.
You know what you should do with your cyber club is find small and medium sized businesses in your community and have those kids go be those businesses CISOs. It's not going to do it for free. It's not going to cost him anything. And the shoot kid might get hired right out of high school, or hired then to be your group could be the cybersecurity institution for these small to medium businesses, just as nothing else than a test case. Just say, hey, we're going to offer this for free. We're going to do our best. We can't promise you won't get compromised, but it's better than what you're doing now. I got to believe there'd be plenty of companies that would take you up on that.
If I didn't know better, I would say you were listening in on Friday's Cybersecurity Club meeting, at which I explained what the different roles were, what a CISO is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that we should look to, you know, that there's lots of resources for them to learn pen testing, et cetera, Cybrary. The friends of mine that are in the business, most of them don't have a formal background in it. They came across it, they found an interest, and then they took off running. These kids, I have a ninth grader, he's just chomping at the bit to get going. the concept of what we could and could not do with businesses, that will be a discussion. My goal is to kind of proof my capstone and then see it evolve locally at first, because these entities, and it's the districts, it's any organization, the churches, the small medium, they don't see the risk, they don't get it. When I was in construction management in the city, there was a HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning. There was a rather well-known, well-established, medium-sized firm that in New York, you use so-called rectangular tin. The HVAC ductwork is computer-controlled, folded, and assembled, lofted that way. Everybody submits plans. They were hit with ransomware, and they decided to fight it on their own. And what they had to do to maintain their delivery, they had to shop their work out to other people who were charging them retail, maybe a little bit less. And long story short, bankruptcy, out of business.
Wow.
So you would think that somebody who's, they call them tin knockers, they with their little hammers and they bang away, fitting all the ductwork together that gets the heating and air conditioning where it's desired. Yeah. If they get compromised, there was an architecture firm, probably 18, 20 people in the firm. And this is kind of where, what led me to head down that street was, they were held with ransomware. Now you'd have weekly design meetings. And if something changes, that needs to go into the architectural plans and be pushed out to the field. They got hit by ransomware. Ended up, that was Monday morning. Wednesday afternoon, they walked $120,000 cash across the Brooklyn Bridge and handed it to somebody with a Russian accent. They couldn't figure out Bitcoin. So they were reduced to actually handing over $120,000. And by Friday, they had pretty much everything back. So it's everywhere. And somebody says, yeah, but it's not going to happen to me. Right. Well, okay. But when it does, you've got a handful that you're not going to have the resources. We found companies with backup. Remember the old, like, 8-track cassettes? There's a cassette type.
Yeah, the tape backups.
And, well, one of my associates, I assembled a bunch of senior, computer types. One woman who does internet searches, everything you might want to know about anybody. Some kids going to the local community college, that one of them just recently got hired by the local hospital, which got hit by ransomware. And if you've been in the hospital lately, you'll see everything is on a computer, and they were held hostage for a long time. So anyway, you bring all these people together. Steve takes in this tape storage and asks them, do you have a backup? Yes, 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 yes. After they told him how comfortable they were with their system, he starts to pull some of the tape out of the cassette, perfectly clear. The magnetic material, the storage medium on the tape had all worn off. It was like the old bodega, let's go to the videotape, and it was just unreadable because the tapes were so old. That was their backup. Mm-hmm. Other companies backing up, where the office manager would take the tapes home on Friday, leave them in her garage, and then she'd bring them back in on Monday. That was their backup. Nobody ever runs an attempt to work from the backup. I will say there are some restaurants that do it, but the vast majority don't. They think they don't need it till it hits. So anyway, your ideas are great. And like I said, it sounds like you were somewhere in the room when
I should say I was not there, but I'm going to ask the same last question I ask everybody, whoever does this podcast. Go back to your 13-year-old self. And what are you going to say to you?
Oh, there's a lot to be said. Who knows? Be careful what you do. It's going to be out there for quite some time. What scares me is some of the kids. I have one teenager left, and now with social media, you start looking at it, realizing, whoops, things that you may not want chasing you the rest of your life. Yeah, it's a completely different world now. So when I was 13, we'd be out riding bicycles all day till the sun went down, and we'd come home for dinner, and that was it. Nowadays, 13-year-old could be a hacking expert, could rent some software and hack mom and dad's bank by dinner time. And if they've got problems, they can call up the helpline and figure out how to make their hack of the local bank more effective. So it just, if I was 13 years old today, it's a different world and it's changing fast. Things that we don't know, artificial intelligence, it's going to really change the world. And entire industries are losing 30, 40, 50% of their manning. You know, think about a career when maybe you're 16, 17. But I guess the freshman in my club, be interesting to see where he is come high school graduation, come college graduation. It's going to be a different world for them.
Well, fortunately, you're there to keep them straight. Well, John, I very much appreciate you taking the time. I know you probably have lesson plans you got to get ready for tomorrow, don't you?
Absolutely. And grading of labs. We're doing labs virtual, although I did do the egg drop on Friday. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing about education now is we can do live simulations of things that you would never try. And as long as the kids can buy into the sim as being what would happen in the real world, it's fascinating. You can make lots of things happen over and over in different ways. And, you know, you'll just have to go with it. I hope by New Year's we're back to full physical in school. But if we're not, I've got the ability to keep going and do more. But I like the old school. For me, the advancement of education was colored chalk.
Well, I will say you're a better man than I, because you went full circle. You went physics teacher to FBI agent back to physics teacher. I could not go back and be a physics teacher again. So God bless you and all that you do.
It's still the kids. It's like cybersecurity. It's the kids. It's the people and what they do. You know, I when I had these kids excited to be in the club, when I had – you know, kids doing a lab and enjoying themselves, that to me was the big payback. So I still enjoy that. I'm refereeing lacrosse. You know, it's similar but different to what it was, you know, 25, 30 years ago. So all good.
Do you ever miss the gun and badge?
Yes, absolutely, because there was some really good things we did. Then you look at some of the, things that went wrong, and you just sit there and go, what were they thinking? There was just saw a special on one of the pay TV channels, and it dealt with the elections, et cetera, and 2016, and the stuff that they were saying, and the stuff that they say the Bureau is doing or not doing. It is somewhat disheartening. But I do believe that the person at the desk with the badge and the gun is out there doing the right thing.
Right.
It's just
we can only
above
hope.
That, not to be personal, but mm-hmm. You start heading above that level and you just, you know, things start maybe getting a little bit more vague. And I understand I don't have all the pieces and all the forces involved, but, there was some good cases we made. And there were some ones that we didn't get that I really wish we did. So a little regret on that, but a good sense of accomplishment on everything else.
All right. That sounds good. Well, John, again, I appreciate you. Enjoy your evening and have fun at school tomorrow. Thanks again.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
As always, I want to thank you for listening to the Cyber Guy podcast. And thanks again to John Griffin for being my guest this week. If you have any questions you'd like me to address on future podcasts or topics that you'd like to hear, feel free to email me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, at thecyberguy.com. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R. Also remember that this is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. If you want more information on cybersecurity awareness topics, please check me out on my LinkedIn profile. It's LinkedIn/IN/Darren Mott, and you'll find all sorts of information on there. Feel free to connect with me there if you're so inclined. As you progress through your week, make sure you understand the cyber threats that are facing you, assess your cyber risk overall, and make sure you proceed wisely. Thanks again. Have a good week.